Talo Falava, I'm Sosef Womoli. Join me for Sister Sounds, a music show dedicated to showcasing the breadth of talented female musicians and performers from across the Pacific. Sister Sounds will bring you amazing local talent mixed with the sounds and vibe our Islander audiences love by artists from across the seas as well. Search up ABC Sister Sounds to listen online or find it in the ABC Listen app.
This is an ABC podcast.
Yakwe, Nisan Bolivinaka, Aloha Kako, Iorana, and good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. On the show today, Papua New Guinea's parliament could soon decide the fate of Bougainville's aspiration for independence. Once a critic, now Solomon Islands Prime Minister has reaffirmed his government's commitment to relations with China. And a joint operation to take down a West Papua rebel group comes after they killed five road construction workers in Papua's Highland province. More on those stories shortly, but before we begin, as always, we'd like to acknowledge that our show comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. I'm your host, Eddie Dubow, and we appreciate your company this morning. Whakawelahi. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Firstly, Papua New Guinea's parliament could soon decide the fate of Bougainville's independence aspirations. Leaders from both the PNG and autonomous Bougainville governments have agreed that the results of the 2019 Bougainville independence referendum will be tabled in PNG's parliament next month. The overwhelming majority of Bougainvillians voted in support of independence, but PNG's parliament effectively has the final say, with MPs to vote on whether to accept or reject the results. While the government have agreed on this important milestone, some big questions remain unanswered, such as when the vote itself will be held, the voting threshold required to accept the results, and what happens if Parliament says no. For more details, we are joined by our reporter Liam Fox. Let's say good morning, Liam.
Good morning, Aggie.
Well, yeah, let's get straight into it. What have the two governments actually agreed to do?
So Bougainville's President Ismail Tirama and PNG's Prime Minister James Marape and other government representatives met at the final meeting of what's called the Joint Supervisory Body, the JSB. Now, that's the forum that was set up under the Bougainville Peace Agreement to facilitate discussions between the two governments after that agreement ended the Bougainville Civil War in the 1990s, known as the Crisis. And since the referendum in 2019, much of the JSB's work has been around developing a roadmap on deciding Bougainville's political future. And at this final meeting, which is historic in its own right that the JSB has had its final meeting, both sides agreed that the results of the referendum would be tabled in the PNG Parliament on the 27th of August. They also agreed that Mr. Marape and Mr. Tirama would jointly decide the date for when the actual vote will take place. That is when MPs will vote on whether to accept or reject the results. And this is important because the vote in Parliament is essentially the final step in the Bougainville Peace Agreement.
Okay, but Liam, what about other issues like the voting threshold for the vote to actually succeed?
Yeah, the JSB statement, a joint statement issued by both sides, signed by both leaders, doesn't mention a voting threshold. This became a big issue back in June after Prime Minister Marape announced that three quarters of MPs would have to vote to accept the results for the vote to succeed. And this angered the Bougainvillean side, firstly because they feel that the threshold is too high and is setting the vote up to fail. And as an example, they point out that to change the constitution of PNG, you only need a two-thirds majority of parliament. But to accept this vote on the referendum, you need there's a high threshold, three-quarters. Secondly, they're upset because they said that the threshold should have been determined jointly by both governments and not unilaterally by PNG. In his address to the JSB before the discussions went behind closed doors, President Tirama reiterated those concerns. He also said that the unilateral decision to set the threshold at three quarters stepped away from what he called the spirit of partnership.
Liam, I have to ask, though, because that leads to this question here. What about the issue of what happens if the PNG Parliament rejects the referendum results?
Yep, that too is another important area that's not specifically addressed in the final statement of the JSB. It does say that the JSB endorsed what's called the Melanesian framework to, quote, give effect to an affirmative decision by the parliament should the parliament endorse the referendum results. But it does not mention what happens if the opposite occurs and the vote fails. Prime Minister Marape has previously said if parliament votes no, that would not be the end of the story, that negotiations would continue around potentially increasing Bougainville's level of autonomy within the state of PNG. But for Bougainville President Ishmael Tirama, independence is not negotiable. And he says PNG's view that parliament has an unfettered discretion to say no is a, quote, dangerous legal fiction. Here's a bit of what he had to say at the opening of the Joint Supervisory Body meeting before discussions went behind closed doors.
The government of Papua New Guinea's position suggests that if we meet its arbitrary criteria, the Minister for Bougainville Affairs might graciously bring a political status back to Parliament for reconsideration at a later date. This insults the intelligence of our people. By doing this, the national government is asking us to trade a constitutional internationally witnessed referendum result for an ambiguous promise of the future. We do not need a clear pathway to revisit that question. The question has been asked, answered and sealed in ink and blood.
Yeah, and that's Bougainville President Ishmael Tirama there. Liam, where does the issue then go from here?
Well, the 27th of August is not far away, just a month and a half, even more so when you consider that the referendum took place 7 years ago and the JSB has been developing a roadmap since then. And as we've discussed, there are still some big issues up in the air. Maybe they'll get cleared up before the date, before the vote in Parliament is decided. Maybe the details are also in the Melanesian framework I referenced earlier. But if so, they weren't mentioned by either of the sides in their own statements following the JSB meeting. And it's also unclear at this stage if the Melanesian framework has been publicly released. The JSB did say in its joint statement afterwards that an independent facilitator and a joint technical team would do awareness among PNG MPs ahead of the vote. The parliament had quite a significant debate on this issue back in June, and quite a lot of MPs expressed their objection to accepting the referendum result. So passing a three-quarter threshold does look difficult at this stage. For its part, the Bougainville government has said it's prepared to unilaterally declare independence if the vote fails. So, look, I think there's still a lot more to come on this long-running, complex and emotional issue.
Yes, as you said, yeah, definitely still a lot to unpack here. But as always, Liam, really appreciate coming on the show and just sharing as to how the situation is developing.
Thanks, Aggie.
That is our ABC reporter, Liam Fox, there.
Join Natasha Matin for Sisters Let's Talk, a program that explores the issues that are in the hearts and minds of Pacific women.
Cut to me landing in Tonga and showing up on my auntie's doorstep, and they had no idea I was coming. It was late at night, and they had no idea who I was. I felt the full weight of my adoption at that time.
Sisters Let's Talk, Thursday mornings at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Good fellow morning. Welcome back to Pacific Beat. We head to Solomon Islands where the Prime Minister Matthew Wale has reaffirmed his government's commitment to relations with China. Mr. Wale was voted into office by MPs in May, but prior to this was a critic of Solomon Islands' 2019 diplomatic switch from Taiwan to China. He told Parliament his government is resetting relations with diplomatic partners and it is committed to the One China policy.
Solomon Islands remains a friend to all and an enemy to none. This government has deliberately reset our foreign relations, and the visits made to our friends were necessary to restore our standing as a reliable partner to each of them. Sir, they have been rewarding as His Excellency outlined, the proper test, Mr. Speaker, of foreign policy is what it delivers for Solomon Islanders. And by that test, sir, the reset has begun well. In that same vein, Mr. Speaker, our relations with the People's Republic of China remain important to our development. And this government reaffirms our continued commitment to the One China principle, the foundation on which our bilateral relations are established. This is settled policy for the Solomon Islands government, and it will be honoured with the same consistency we bring to all our friendships.
That there is Prime Minister Matthew Wale, who has visited Australia, the United States and Japan since taking office and had dispatched his foreign minister for a visit to China. Now, an influential Italgi women's group is calling for traditional owners to be given control of marine resources, including popular surf breaks in Fiji. Under current laws, traditional owners have rights over fishing grounds, known as korikori, but they have no control over other marine resources, including those used for by tourists. The Songo Songo Vakamarama told a parliamentary committee on a new marine areas bill that ownership of marine resources should no longer be in the hands of the state. Its president, Ari Final the Bangaundoro, called for indigenous rights to be respected.
We think you should really look at the surfing law, and that the owners of the Ngolingolis should have a say in who gets to surf in their areas, and not just because they provide a leisure activity for tourism. That the surfing bill should not encroach into the rights of the Ngolingoli owners in the way it is now. That's a number one concern, because people can go and surf anywhere they like, as it is, without the awareness of the owners of the Ngolingoli, let alone the people who live around there, and to what extent these kinds of activities interfere and encroach on the rights of people to go and fish. So that's our number one submission.
And that is Ari Final Dabagaundoro, president of the Songo Songo Vakamarama, speaking at the parliamentary committee hearing into the commercial use of marine areas bill. Pacific Beat. All right, Indonesia's security forces have launched a joint operation to pursue the group of West Papua National Liberation Army fighters who killed five road construction workers in Papua's Highland Province on Sunday. It comes amid reports that the deepening conflict between the pro-independence Papuan fighters and Indonesian forces has caused mass displacement of village communities in the regions. The WPNLA has claimed responsibility for killing the Indonesian workers, alleging they were undercover intelligence agents. Well, joining me now to discuss this is Dr. Cammy Webb-Gannam, the coordinator of the West Papua Project at the University of Wollongong. With that, I say welcome, Doctor, to Pacific Beat.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Doctor, look, what have we seen play out since the killings over the weekend?
There's a pattern of these killings in West Papua, and whenever there is violence committed by the West Papua Liberation Army, there's disproportionate violence then in response from the Indonesian military. And there's always a counterinsurgency, is what they call it. So they come back and it's leading to further mass displacement of Indigenous populations, further escalation of conflict, further terror for the civilian populations in the area that this is happening in Tolikara Regency. Mm.
And as you talk about, you know, there's a pattern of these killings from West Papua National Liberation Army. Are you aware whether or not they've said anything about this?
Well, they have claimed that this is their work. So they have claimed that what has happened was that the Indonesian workers were working on What is part of a massive development initiative in West Papua? So there are road construction workers in the Highlands and Tolikara Regency. Now, what the TPMPB or the West Papua Liberation Army is claiming is that these construction workers were also spies for the Indonesian military and that they had no business being there, that it was dangerous for them to be there. And so they were actually not civilians. They were part of the army, and therefore this was justified military action on behalf of the TPMPB.
Are you also aware, maybe, though, Doctor, like from even the Indonesian security forces, have they said anything about this whole situation?
They're denying that the workers were spies. And it's really hard to know what the truth is in the situation. There's also there's a pattern of this happening, but there's also a long history of West Papuan security personnel, military personnel serving a dual function. So under Indonesian President Suharto, this was called Dwi Fungsi Abri. So it was the dual function of the Indonesian Armed Forces. Mm. And it was a political doctrine in which the national defense, the military served two jobs, national defense and social political control. And so there's credibility to the claims that these workers could have been working for the Indonesian military. Whether or not there's evidence for that, we haven't seen that. It makes sense that the TPMPB is going to claim that this was the case because it then justifies their actions as part of armed conflict, of an established armed conflict. And it makes sense that the Indonesian military is going to say that, no, they weren't spies, because that then undermines their position that they were civilians. But we've also seen, this is part of, although this is in the Highlands, it can also be linked to what's happening in the south of Papua with the National Strategic Project, which is one of the largest land clearings in the world. It's under current President Prabowo. It's a clearing of more than 2 million hectares of indigenous land in the south of Papua for palm oil, but also sugarcane, bioethanol, and agri-fuels, corn. And what's happening is that the land is being cleared by the military. So it's military, but they're also serving civilian functions, as in they're undertaking civilian work. And so, again, this speaks to the question of whether or not they were spies. They may have been, they may not have been. It's tragic when people are killed, but I think this is a part of a larger question around the naming of the conflict in West Papua, and whether or not it justifies, it classifies the international humanitarian law definitions of non-international armed conflict. And so it's playing out in this context.
Yeah, I was just going to ask that because, you know, you talked about how credible these claims were. I'm just wondering, yeah, what's the impact that this scenario has on the bigger context of conflict between Indonesia and West Papuan independence groups? Because you talk about there the land clearings, President Prabowo. There just seems to be a bigger issue behind these.
Well, it's more than 60 years now since Indonesian occupation of West Papua. So if we look at it from the long, you know, historical view, there's been six decades of brutal Indonesian occupation in West Papua. And during that period, West Papuans have been fighting both in terms of military and, you know, organized armed conflict, but also peacefully working towards self-determination in West Papua. I think if we're looking at it from a military perspective, we've got to keep in mind that there are probably less than 1,500 members of the Liberation Army, the West Papuan Liberation Army, and then you need to compare this to the approximately 90,000 at minimum at any one time Indonesian soldiers and other security forces in West Papua. So it's a very, very unequal armed conflict. The West Papuan military or Liberation Army has probably less than 400 firearms, and so also relying on traditional weapons such as spears, machetes, and so on. So it's incredibly unequal. And so the advantage that the TPMPB, the Liberation Army, has is their knowledge of the terrain, their knowledge of the jungles and the local areas in which they're operating, which Indonesian military does not have. They also have access and links to local populations who are sometimes willing to let them operate within civilian areas, although then this also comes to the issue of international humanitarian law, which I'd like to draw attention to a report that's been worked on by Dr. Budi Honawan in Jakarta and his team, and they're looking at what the implications of applying international humanitarian law is to this conflict. And it means that it would hold accountable both the Indonesian military but also the West Papuan Liberation Army to not be targeting civilians, to not be using civilian places and spaces as military operation sites. And so what's happening, not if we're looking at the kind of more recent impact, I just want to mention a 2018 incident that was similar to this that happened in Duga Regency, so probably 70 to 90 kilometres away from the current incident. And this was in December 2018 when the TPMB killed between 19 and 30, we don't have exact figures, but of road workers in the... we're working on the Trans-Papua Highway. I'll get to that in a second because that context is important. But they also accused these workers of being spies for the Indonesian army, and they had warned them, apparently, to stay away from the TPNPB's operations in December. It was a very important time for West Papuan independence activists, for most West Papuans, actually, Indigenous West Papuans, because around December 1st, they celebrate their hoped-for independence, usually through raising their Morning Star flag, their national flag. And so they were saying that the road workers were spying on them, were trying to keep an eye on what was going on. And so there was a mass murder of the road workers. And this was what sparked. So this is known as the Duga Massacre in 2018. And this is what had then sparked massive reprisals in the highlands and turned the highlands into a specific war zone. And since that time, probably in excess of 125,000 internally displaced peoples have been living away from their homes, their gardens, their livestock, and for 6 years now have not had access to proper nutrition, to health care, and to education. And so this is happening in that context. I can just I can point to a couple of other incidences. So the kidnapping of the New Zealand pilot Philip Mertens was on the news a lot about approximately 3 years ago, and this happened also in this region of the highlands of West Papua, where the TPMPB is saying to anyone external to West Papua, so any Americans, any New Zealand nationals, don't fly your aircraft in here. This is a war zone. We are, if you're a civilian pilot, don't come here because you may be using civilian aircraft to bring in military personnel and military goods, and we're not going to have that. And it also serves as, you know, if this happened a month ago, an American pilot was killed for the same reason by the TPMPB. So it's a warning to the world that this is what's happening. They're also trying to bring attention to the conflict in West Papua, but also saying don't use civilians and civilian aircraft to contribute to this war.
Yeah, Doctor, I want to get into the fact that, you know, with, like, you talk about the 60 years of, you know, West Papua having to fight for self-determination. I'm just wondering, you know, will this now have an impact on that potential dialogue, right, for self-determination, or is this really pushing a solution further out of reach?
I think it's pushing a solution further out of reach. The more the violence escalates, the further away they're West Papuans are from achieving peace with justice in their land. So it the more violence contributes to more violence.
Sure.
And so the conflict escalates, and the less likely the Indonesian government is going to be open to any kind of peaceful solution. The solution or the resolution from the Indonesian military's perspective and the Indonesian government's perspective is more military, because they view the West Papuan independence movement as variously criminal gangs, as treasonous, as massive troublemakers. And particularly under Prabowo, who has a record of human rights violations in East Timor. It's about stamping out the independence movement rather than trying to come to an understanding of historical and current grievances and trying to come to any kind of peaceful solution.
Well, obviously there is still a lot to unpack, but that's all the time that we have for this morning, Dr. Cammy. But do really appreciate you coming on and sharing this morning.
Yeah, anytime. Thank you, Aggie.
Thank you so much. That is Dr. Cammy Webber-Gannon, the coordinator of the West Papua Project at the University of Wollongong.
Yo, Michael Chow, what's with the guitar, bro?
Jake McQuire, haven't you heard? Entries for Pacific Break open this month.
Brother, you know this competition is for up and coming artists from the Pacific and Timor-Leste, right?
Just imagine it. Joining the Pacific Break Winners Hall of Fame alongside Sprigga Mech, Danielle, Juben, Chris Rohoimai, Mantis, and now Michael Chow. Okay, I better go book some studio time.
Entries open Wednesday, the 26th of August, so get your original tracks together and head to abc.net.au/Pacific Break to find out more.
Want to immerse yourself in sport and the stories of athletes from across the Pacific? Well, join me, Sam Wykes, alongside some of the most talented journalists and sports commentators from across the region for Fresh Off the Field. Each week, we'll also bring you interviews with Pacific athletes leaving their mark on the international stage and those aspiring to do the same. From cricket to netball, athletics to football, and everything in between. Fresh Off the Field, Thursdays at 4 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, if you've just joined us, this is Pacific Beat and I'm your host, Aggie DeBol. Here's just a quick recap of stories on the show so far. We spoke about Papua New Guinea's parliament set to decide the fate of Bougainville's aspiration for independence. Once a critic, now Solomon Islands Prime Minister has actually reaffirmed his government's commitment to its relations with China. And a joint operation to take down a West Papua rebel group has started after killing five road construction workers in Papua's Highland province. You would have just heard that conversation. Now, still to come, Fijiana women's team have a new coach. But before that, let's head to your news wrap.
Hold the front page!
Pinaka Whakalevu, welcome back to Pacific Beat. Yes, we head around the region now to get the latest headlines, and that's brought to you by our producer, Whenau Furo, who's back in the studio. Fefe.
So bad, I'm all right. Aggie, yourself?
You've had a bit of a break?
Yes.
Nice sleep-ins. Thank you very much, though, for coming back and doing early mornings with me. Yes, we've got quite a few stories to get through. This one's really interesting. Hearing reports that Australian police officer has actually survived an armed ambush in Papua New Guinea's highlands while serving with the country's police force. What's the update here?
Yes, PNG law enforcement say gunmen ambushed a vehicle that angered Provincial Police Commander Chief Superintendent Steve Harris, an Australian who took the role, assumed the role. The gunman opening fire as he traveled with his driver and three reservists. Our Papua New Guinea correspondent Marion Farr filed this report for the bulletins yesterday. Let's have a listen.
Chief Superintendent Stephen Harris was travelling to arrest suspects in a murder investigation in PNG's Highlands this week when he and other Papua New Guinean officers were ambushed and shot at. They returned fire and no one was injured. Chief Superintendent Harris joined PNG's police force last year and was recently tasked with eradicating illegal guns from Enga province where the attack took place. PNG Prime Minister James Marape has called the incident a direct attack on the rule of law.
And as Marion Farr said, no casualties. PNG 24 reports that as the attack unfolded, Harris reportedly handed his service pistol to his driver and returned fire with a police-issued carbine. While the reservists shielded him from a hail of bullets, they've been lauded for their bravery in protecting their commander. The date, the attack occurred on Monday. Gun violence, a big problem in Papua New Guinea, of course, especially in Enga province. We hear a lot of deaths up there.
All right. Well, thank you for that report. Let's head to some sports news, though. Fiji's women's rugby team, Fijiana, they'll take on South Africa this weekend. I believe this is the first time for Fiji to host the Springboks, right?
It is. That's right. It will be the first test match on Fijian soil for South Africa. The women's Springboks told Fiji Times in Fiji Village that they've shaken off their jet lag. It's a very long trip.
Long
flight from South Africa to Fiji. Fijiana boasts a strong team packed with players from the draw who made it to the Super Rugby final last month.
That's right.
The Springbok women have always been a force to reckon with on the international stage. They're known for their physicality. They rank 10th on the table, 3 places above Fijiana. The last time these teams played was at the Women's 2022 Rugby World Cup, where Fijiana secured a narrow 21-17 victory. I actually reported on that game at Waitakere Stadium in West Auckland, and it was an amazing game. It went back and forth until the last minute when Fiji snatched the game with a try from Carolina Naisewa, their loose forward. And according to reports, she will be playing in this game.
Oh, wow.
And no doubt the South Africans will be out for revenge. The game kicks off this Saturday at the HFC Bank Stadium in Suva.
Of course, I'm sure our Fijian community will be looking forward to that game. We head to where the police are actually now seeking the public's help. This is in Samoa, though. About there's video evidence in a rugby league death investigation. What happened here?
Yes, well, they're seeking more video footage of a brawl, all-out rugby brawl, during which a rugby league player by the name of Savea Tama Famavaenga, Savea Tama, a.k.a. Rachel, he passed away, collapsed unconscious on the rugby field. But they don't, it was between Marist, Samoa's local Marist team, and another. But there's uncertainty as how he actually died, if it was a result of
that fight,
of being attacked or a health condition. It occurred at Vailala Rugby Field on Saturday. And in a statement issued on Sunday, Samoa police urged anyone who recorded the incident or who has relevant footage to submit it directly to investigators. I've seen 3 videos of different angles. We don't see what happened before he collapsed.
Right.
But it was a terrible incident. He collapsed and was completely unconscious. Eyewitnesses told the Samoa Observer that tensions escalated after the match. So a brawl didn't just occur on field, but occurred later on. But police haven't commented on the details of the alleged incident yet. No arrests have been announced and investigations are ongoing.
It does highlight, though, right, that there is a problem
Actually, and even recently, New South Wales, there's recently been a crackdown on brawls in rugby. Rugby league's notorious for brawls, but there's efforts to try and keep the spot clean.
All right, yeah, no, that needs to be done, definitely. All right, well, look, as always, Finau, really appreciate you coming through with these headlines from across the region. That's our producer, Finau Funua, here with your news wrap.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
We head to sport now. While the question over who will get the permanent head coaching position with the Flying Fijians is still to be resolved, the FRU have secured the services of arguably the best person available to take charge of their national women's team. Willie Walker has won the last 3 Super Rugby titles in a row with the Blues in New Zealand, and now his sights are set on taking Fijiana to the knockout round of the next World Cup. His appointment came at just a matter of days before the first of 2 test matches on home soil for the women's team against South Africa. But Walker is biding his time before taking the reins, so he won't be in charge of Fijiana on Saturday in Suva.
Look, I'll be honest, I will take a back seat this first week and really rely on the job that our coaches have been doing here. Mike Legg has done a great job as the interim head coach looking after this group whilst I've been busy with Super Rugby back home. I've been in the country 2 days and had the opportunity to go down and meet the players and get to see a couple of trainings and have a little bit of input, but I don't want to step on anyone's toes at this stage. I really want to get an understanding of the group and how we are and connect with players and all of those things before I start to implement some small changes if they need to be done. But really, it's just about getting an understanding of this group and seeing where I can help initially and going from there.
But the fact that you're in Fiji as the team builds up to the first test against South Africa, a second test to come a week later, you're going to get a pretty instant rundown of where this side is at, I would have thought, which most coaches have to wait quite a while for.
No, exactly. And again, that's probably one of the upsides of it. A downside is that it is straight away and haven't had the opportunity really to connect with this group and to learn. But it does give me a good insight into, you know, where we're going to be at leading into the next game anyway, and then looking into the future around how we operate. Yeah, it's good that we're straight into work, and I get to see the girls being put under pressure from the outset, so get a really good understanding and a grasp of the character that we've got within this group, as well as working alongside the new management group.
Tell me, as someone who has had enormous success as a Super Rugby coach in New Zealand, the Blues have won the last three Super Rugby women's titles, most recently just a couple of weeks ago. What has persuaded you that taking on the job with Fijiana is right for you at this time?
For me, it's a natural progression of where I wanted to get to. I want to coach international rugby, and this is a great opportunity that I've been afforded. I had been with the Blues for 6 years, and I had done all I could, I think, domestically within New Zealand and the New Zealand rugby landscape. And at this time, there isn't an opportunity to push further in terms of international experience. And so being appointed the head coach here of the Fijiana means a great deal, and I'm really looking forward to just the opportunity to test and challenge myself at that international level, continue to build experience and knowledge, and hopefully guide Fiji to develop even further and see where we can get to.
So you've severed your ties with the Blues completely. You won't be juggling two jobs?
No, I won't be juggling two jobs. It would be too difficult to be able to do that. I would love to have stayed on. I've built some great relationships with players and management, the club as a whole, and I'm very grateful for that opportunity with them. But one of our core pillars within that group was around opportunities, and this is an opportunity for me to grow and change and challenge and test myself at that next level.
And will you have a role too in the broader development of women's rugby in Fiji?
Yes, as part of the broader scope, there'll be a look at pathways and development, some coach development, player TID, everything that goes with trying to run a high-performance program and building relationships with clubs and schools and provinces to get players a little bit of understanding of what high-performance means before they get into an international program. We need to build those pathways so that these young aspiring players have the opportunity to develop and not be put under pressure straight away at test match level.
And I guess one target would be progress in the next Women's World Cup. Fiji didn't manage to get out of the pool last time.
And there's no reason why, if things track well and we get a good program up and running, that Fijiana can't be pushing at that level. I think they have the potential and the calibre of players to be able to do that. And we just have to create a program around them to allow that growth and opportunity to push further in the international game.
And how do you see the dynamic between yourself as head coach of Fijiana and Mike Legg in his role with the Drua? He's looking after the national side on this occasion. It's quite interesting how all that will work, it seems to me.
I think so. I think there's a benefit in having alignment with the Drua, because the majority of the players that are playing in this international squad are part of the Drua. And so what that means is they get the opportunity to train and play together for a lot more time than some other international teams do. So it's going to be an important relationship between myself and Mike, and utilising his knowledge because he knows these girls really well, and just continuing to, one, help him in terms of his coaching aspirations, but two, utilising his inside knowledge of these players to help me in my role as the head coach here.
And that's Willie Walker, New Zealand's Super Rugby maestro and now Fijiana's head coach. He was talking to Richard Hewitt on the line from Suva. And finally, around 50,000 years ago, a unique kangaroo lived in the mountain rainforests of New Guinea. The Protomnodon timbuna was the size of a red kangaroo, but more muscular and stocky. But unlike most kangaroos, it didn't hop. It moved around on all four legs. Not much is known about the megafauna, but the discovery of a single tooth from the Latitu Cave on Papua New Guinea's northwest in 2024 showed that the species did not become extinct as early or as previously thought. I spoke to Laureate Research Fellow Lucas Kongoulis from the University of Western Australia about uncovering these fossil secrets.
This is an extinct species. Our idea of what it looked like is based on what its skeleton looked like, and this would have been a kangaroo that doesn't look like anyone today. So we think it was, instead of hopping on its hind legs as the main way of getting around, it probably crawled about on all fours in a much slower, kind of lumbering manner. That because of that also, its upper arms would have been really muscular, and overall the body would have looked really stocky and muscular compared to the sort of lean kangaroos that we have today. So it would have been a really strange looking animal to us, I think. It's part of the broader kangaroo family. So, you know, we think this animal was actually fairly closely related to red and grey kangaroos in the big scheme of things.
How surprising then was it to find that evidence, you know, that these kangaroos had survived for thousands of years, especially along that New Guinea coast?
It was pretty surprising. So over the last few years, other teams working in New Guinea have been finding these little bits of evidence which suggest that this kangaroo and another one that was probably quite similar, also lived in the sort of rainforest environment, had survived for much longer than the sort of other megafauna did in Australia. In Australia, we think they're all gone by about 40,000 years. In New Guinea, there was, these, as I was saying, these little bits of evidence that suggest maybe they're around to about the peak of the Ice Age, so like 20,000 years ago. We, you know, which sort of made sense because we look at this thing of like the end of the Ice Age as this, you know, end of an era, big marker of time change. So you think all these giant animals are probably gone by then. So we look working on the material from this site, which is way, way, way younger. You know, lo and behold, we found the bone from this animal. So we had found a tooth from this species previously in one of the other sites we were looking at. Unfortunately, the circumstances in which it was found meant that there was actually no way to tell when it had been. It could be 60,000 years, it could be like 100,000 years old. No real way to tell how old it is. The interesting thing about this site is that it was more or less underwater up until like just shy of 7,000 years ago. So there's like this almost like a beach deposit in the site. And then as soon as the water levels recede, people start living in the cave, probably because it's right next to these really good marine resources. We were really, really surprised to find it there because we just had no idea that they would be there that late.
And then we look at things like, you know, human interaction or hunting or even climate change. Do you think that somehow maybe would have contributed to the loss or extinction of these kangaroos?
I think both have probably played their role. In this particular area, the climate change sort of gets thrown around in this bigger picture of megafauna extinctions in Australia and New Guinea. Here it seems to be really relevant. The reason is, and we see that a range of animals, which today are only found in the mountains of New Guinea, because they live in this specific type of forest that's found at high altitudes, used to be living on the coast, right? So, you know, we're talking like 100 meters above sea level, and they used to be there. Then they all go extinct basically at the same time this giant kangaroo does. So what we think is that this type of montane, high elevation forest, when the temperatures were colder, used to exist a lot lower down. As temperatures rose, it had to sort of retreat higher and higher up the mountain slopes. Unfortunately, the mountains around this part of New Guinea are really quite low. So eventually it sort of ran out of room to keep going up and just disappeared. It got replaced by this tropical rainforest that they have along the coast today. So once that habitat was gone, creatures that are sort of adapted to it and dependent on it would have faced increasingly tough situations. And something big like this, I don't think it would have taken long for it to sort of succumb to any kind of hunting pressure.
What does this discovery maybe reveal about New Guinea's unique biodiversity? Do you know, and its importance, I suppose, of trying to understand natural history?
Yeah, great question. New Guinea is sort of like this treasure trove of biodiversity. There's not a year goes by without some big discovery. Quite happy to consider this one of those big discoveries. There's so much, not just for mammals and marsupials, but birds and reptiles as well. The common theme is that there's interesting showcase here of kind of mass localized and sort of island-wide extinctions. There's big, big turnovers of biodiversity happening. These are really good case studies telling us what we can expect when they're subjected to pressure from humans and changing habitats.
Wow. What does this then tell us about even maybe just the movement of animals between Australia and New Guinea?
You know, we've got this more complex issue of where did the fauna in New Guinea come from. We do think that for the most part, a lot of them have come from Australia. And they've entered New Guinea at various times when the sort of two land masses met. And there was a bit of exchange the other way. So, you know, for instance, we think that echidnas probably came from New Guinea originally and then spread into Australia.
Well, why should our people in the Pacific really be invested or even just care about this type of discovery?
This is part of their heritage. It's important to, I guess, understand what's gone on in the background of the environment. These are really, really pressing issues all across the Pacific, particularly in New Guinea in terms of deforestation and habitat change, habitat degradation. The specifics of this discovery aside, all the research that's being done on documenting biodiversity change in New Guinea are really relevant to what's going on today, environmental preservation and the consequences of what happens when that's lost. So once these species are gone, they don't come back. They're dependent on quite specific places to live in.
And that there is Lucas Gongulis, Laureate Research Fellow from the University of Western Australia. Pacific Beat. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Looking back at one of our main stories today, Bougainville's President Ishmael Tarama has lashed out at Papua New Guinea's parliament for dragging its feet on endorsing the country's pathway to independence.
This insults the intelligence of our people. By doing this, the national government is asking us to drag a constitutional international witness referendum result for an ambiguous promise of the future.
Find that story when you type Pacific Beat or Radio Australia into your search engine. But our team will be back same time tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time. But you can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned because your news is up next. And coming up after that, it is Nisha Daily. So until next time, o tua awhātou, this is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.